Today, on this episode of the PeerDirect Special Spotlight.
Fernando, how would you characterize where we are today with the PPF classification? And what progress do you think has been made since this initial syndrome was introduced?
Today, Drs. Montesi and Martinez joined the podcast to discuss PPF classifications. Where are we now in this PeerDirect Specialist Spotlight? All opinions expressed are those of the presenters and do not necessarily reflect the views of this educational initiative supporters.
Hello, I'm Dr. Sydney Montesi. I'm a pulmonary and critical care specialist at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, Massachusetts, and an associate professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School.
And I'm Dr. Fernando Martinez. I'm the academic chief of the Division of Pulmonary, Allergy, and Critical Care Medicine, and I'm also the Joseph D. Early Chair in Biomedical Research at the University of Massachusetts Chan Medical School in Worcester, Mass.
As recognition of progressive pulmonary fibrosis has grown, so too has the need for clearer frameworks to help clinicians define and identify progression across a multitude of fibrotic interstitial lung disease. While the ATS-ERS classification criteria have helped bring greater structure to this process, there are important questions and areas of debate that remain regarding how PPF is defined, validated, and applied in practice. Ready to get started, Fernando?
Oh, lordy, lordy, lordy.
All right. Fernando, how would you characterize where we are today with the PPF classification? And what progress do you think has been made since this initial syndrome was introduced?
Ask me an easy question, Sydney. So I think that, Sydney, I was part of the DSMB for the in-build criteria, the nintedanib study. So I remember hearing a lot of these discussions as they were taking place. And I think that the idea that there are patients that have non-IPF, that don't have IPF by all the traditional criteria, that can exhibit progression was a major advance. And that those patients who met those arbitrary criteria could be treated with an antifibrotic and have benefit, another advance. And so that sort of created this whole process of progressive fibrosing ILD. We had a different term that we used before, if you remember, Sydney. And so that was a turning point in the field, and certainly for patients and their families. That was a good thing. And the criteria for progression that were used in that study were not completely arbitrary, as you'll remember. They were based on IPF data that had been published over the prior several decades, particularly some of the physiological progression and symptomatic progression. So those were based on a construct that had biological plausibility. And so the ATS and the ERS and the associated organizations, as you remember, there were multiple groups that joined that particular panel, tried to provide some construct of what progressive disease could look like. We spent more than a year, Sydney, arguing these things in that position statement. And it became clear that there were people who agreed with them and there were people who didn't agree with them. And so we ended up having the concept that, yes, this progressive component is seen in non-IPF patients. Woo, it's great. And that there's treatment for them. Woo, great. But exactly how did you define this progression? So then we had this long series of discussions regarding forced vital capacity. Okay, FVC. We have known that FVC decreases in an intermediate time frame, predict long-term badness. We're all in agreement. Couldn't agree completely on what the threshold was. We knew FVC was one of them. DLCO, we had a long discussion and said, all right, nobody's ever used DLCO before in this, but we know what DLCO changes. So we introduced DLCO. Okay. Then symptoms, clearly symptoms for the patient is the most important thing because they can feel that they're getting worse. And then we had CT, and we had all these arguments about whether it should be quantitative CT or whether it should be two radiologists looking at these things independently. And okay. So Sydney, we make a series of recommendations. But we're in that document in the blue chart. Within a day, Sydney, of that going online, there were a series of articles, letters to the editor saying, what are you guys talking about? This is completely arbitrary. You've had no major, you're setting the field back. I'm like, oh my God. And I said, well, this is good. This is actually why you generate some of these things, because there's clearly a need to be more definitive. And so, you've seen what's happened over the last few years. there's been this persistent controversy. And you remember, Sydney, there have been a series of studies that have been have used various pharmacotherapeutic approaches that have used very different thresholds, even for the FVC, 10%, 5%, 6 months, 1 year, 2 years. And it was like, okay. And so it was clear that we've had some very instructive components from this last 5 years. Progression does occur in non-IPF. And those patients who progress don't do well. And so then the discussion regarding antifibrotic therapy is clearly one that you then need to have with the patient and their family. But I think that there is still some concern amongst many of us that the exact format for how we predict progression in an individual patient is not settled yet. And I think that what I can tell clinicians and patients is that you do need to be followed carefully for however you want to define progression, because progression is a bad thing, and you've got pharmacotherapies that can attenuate that. And so I think that, you know, we've all understood that more regular physiological testing, particularly the FVC and likely the DLCO, are going to be valuable. 10% is a threshold that we published decades ago in IPF, and that remains a very consistent threshold. 5% may be helpful if you have other evidence, and I think that's some of the things that we're testing now. And then the presence of worsening symptoms, Sydney, this goes back to the IPF literature. There were a series of papers that were published in the Blue Journal. This is probably before you were born, Sydney. This is, you know, 20, 30 years ago. And all of them showed the same thing. There was one from us at Michigan. There was one from the University of Colorado. There was one from the Brompton. All of which showed that symptoms independently predicted bad outcomes in a patient, no matter what happened to the physiology or even the imaging components. And so I think that a patient who tells you, I just feel worse, Dr. Montesi, I feel bad, it just triggers in your mind, okay, we got to be extra careful here to make sure that there's not evidence of fibrosis progression. And then, the, you know, the CT scan literature, Sydney, is just, you're an imaging expert in this field, so you know exactly what the imaging components are. And I still think we're in a qualitative, yeah, it looks worse kind of a sense, but hopefully at some point you and your colleagues will give us something that's quantitative. And so I think all of us have become more comfortable with being able to combine those components, symptoms, physiology, and some of the imaging components as well, in trying to decide whether there's progression.
Please join us for the next part of our discussion.
And that's today's special spotlight. Thank you for joining us for this episode of PureDirect Medical News Podcast. For more stories like these, visit us at PureDirect.com. Thoughts, comments, or suggestions? Please leave us a review on your preferred listening platform or email us at editorial@PureDirect.com. Listen and subscribe at Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also download our Amazon Alexa Flash Briefing Medical News Roundup and just ask, what's my flash briefing? Thanks today to our guests, Drs. Montesi and Martinez. Join me next time for the episode where we cover the latest stories in the world of medicine.